Welcome to Prophecy Radio, the Percy Jackson podcast that will keep you up to date on all things Rick Riordan and Rick Riordan Presents, including upcoming books, adaptations, and more. I'm Karen, and I'm once again joined by Kristen.
Hello, everyone.
I gave you such a big introduction last week that felt like a letdown.
That's okay.
I just said your name.
I can't always be that excited.
Fair enough. Me neither. You can contact us at Prophecy Podcast on Twitter or at Prophecy Radio Podcast on Tumblr, Instagram, and Facebook, and at Prophecy Radio Podcast at gmail.com. We love hearing from you, so please send us more messages.
Yes, please.
We need the approval.
Let us know that we're not so bad at this. That would be great.
Yeah. Okay, we have a pretty cool episode this week, and before we get into our main discussion, we're going to do a little bit of news and updates. Not a whole lot going on right now, but we do have some interesting things to talk about. First and foremost, something not related to Percy Jackson whatsoever, but I'm making it related to Percy Jackson.
This will be fun.
Yeah. So, as you guys know, we are a part of the Subjectify Media family, and Natalie and I started Subjectify Media when Hypebull closed down so that we could continue writing about the stuff we love. And we have friends who come on and write for us every once in a while. And one of Natalie's friends, Nikki, wrote an article about The Wheel of Time, the Amazon Prime show, which is based on the book series. And basically, she's been a 30-year-long fan of this book series. And it's getting adapted. And the first three episodes are out now. Actually, I think the fourth one might be out now, too. But when she wrote this, none of the episodes had been out yet, and she wrote an article titled The Wheel of Time and How I Learned to Stop Worrying and Love the Adaptation. Yes. And I read this article, and it was really, really good. Like, she's such a good storyteller, and she kind of explains how, I think she was like 19 when she first read the books, and she, every time a new one come out, she would start the series over and read them again, and it's just like, it's just like her favorite book series. And of course, when something you love that much gets adapted, like Percy Jackson,
yeah,
you tend to be a little bit more critical of it. And I really enjoyed her article, and I think that Percy Jackson fans can get a lot out of reading it. I'm pretty sure it doesn't have any spoilers in it. It's basically just about her experience as a fan and really, you know, having high hopes for the adaptation, but also understanding that the adaptation isn't going to be exactly like the books. And in fact, the adaptation will bring something different and new to the table. And I kept thinking about Percy Jackson when I was reading this because, of course, we're all really excited for the Disney Plus show, and I have high hopes for it, specifically because Rick and Becky are involved and because they have a really good foundation for the show. But also, I'm kind of excited for it to be a little different, too, because it's like experiencing the book series for the first time again, because you don't necessarily know what's coming. Like, it'll hit a lot of the main beats. I don't think they're going to change anything major, but we'll get new information from Rick's brain that we've never had before. And like, isn't that the ideal scenario for a fan?
I mean, yeah.
So I have watched the first three episodes of Wheel of Time, and like, it's not bad. I don't think that it's like, it hasn't really pulled me in yet, but I'm going to keep watching because I think it'll be exciting. So yeah. So if you guys end up reading that article, let me know what you think. And if you like it, go tweet at Nikki, because she poured a lot of her heart into that article, and she's going to start covering Wheel of Time for us on the website, which is pretty cool because
yeah,
I like having new friends and she seems awesome. Okay, back to the Percy Jackson world, or I guess the Rick Riordan world, because this is also has nothing to do with Percy Jackson, but The Last Fallen Star has insider notes that you can read through on Goodreads. This is The Last Fallen Star by Gracie Kim, and she basically said, like, it's like putting 11 sticky notes throughout the book, and you guys can just read, like, my thoughts on certain parts, and it was really cool. Like, basically, she takes a couple of sentences or a paragraph from the book and explains what it means, explains where that idea came from, just little like fun facts. And a lot of it goes to like back into the mythology and might explain something that isn't necessarily explained in the book. And it was really cool to read through this. And she's just like a really fun person. So it's just interesting and fun. And I think that more authors should do this because I love getting that kind of background info.
It's funny because a lot of romance authors that have like personal websites, not all of them do, but a lot of them do, especially if they're indie at all. A lot of times they'll have like a section of one shots that'll either be side characters from a book that they know they can't write a whole book for. So they'll just do like a single scene or a quick collection of scenes or something. Because they need to, like, exercise the character from their brain. Like,
exercise the demons.
like, I love this character and I want to write them a thing, but I don't have a story for them. So here's a little thing. Hopefully it'll, you know, move them on so that I can continue to write other stuff. And so I've read a whole bunch of, like, either one-shots or notes about a character or, like, Kate Canterbury, her characters, they're brothers and sisters, like, there's a family at the center of, like, the whole series, and they're architects, and, like, she'll randomly just do, like, email chains. Like,
I remember and you so talking about
it'll
these.
Just be, like, since they all work together, it'll be, you know, Shannon will send an email to Patrick and be, like, did you notice what Riley was wearing today at our staff meeting? Like, can we talk to him about, yes, we're all family, but you need to put socks and shoes on when you come to work? Or, like, stuff like that. Like, it'll just be random asides. And then Patrick will email Riley, and Riley will email Shannon and be like, I know you complained about me. And, like, you know, it's like, I love that stuff. Yeah. Like, just getting even a little bit more of the character or getting into the author's mind about the characters. It's so much fun. I mean, that's what... So, I mean, that little extra stuff just makes you a bigger fan. It's like, yeah. I got another little insight into my favorite characters, my favorite book series. Mm-hmm. So, love that stuff.
Yeah, it allows you to live in that world again for the first time, like, a little bit more. And that's why I always like, you know, Rick's crossover stories and the short stories and, like, all the other little guides that he's put out and stuff. It's just a really cool way to, like, keep that world more populated, and it grows ever bigger, and, like, I'm not going to complain about that.
Yeah.
Speaking of Rick's books, Reed Riordan has a quiz on their website asking which... It's basically a quiz to see which you should read or reread first, Magnus Chase and The King Chronicles. And I was shocked because I love Magnus Chase so, so much, and I got The King Chronicles when I took this, and I was like... Interesting choice, okay, but I'm not that mad about it because we're gonna get the movie soon enough, and I definitely need to read those. So,
well, I wonder if the quiz is weighted. If you answer the questions and it seems like you know more about Magnus, or like, well, if it leads all, you to,
it was all like, what's your favorite season? What's your favorite, like, math, or not math, your favorite school subject? And so I did not pick math, just for the record.
Just
I don't know where that came from.
Just note that, yeah.
Yeah, and so it was basically, and at the end it was like, oh, well, it seems like your interests better align with what happens in the King Chronicles. And I was like, I can't be that mad at that. Like, it seemed like it was at least based on some information, so.
That's interesting. Because I was thinking, like, if it was weighing the two, like, you've read Magnus, you've understood Magnus, you've taken Magnus in better, maybe you need to read Cain again.
Yeah.
But that's interesting.
Yeah.
It's an interesting way to do it.
Kind of cool. So if you guys take that, let us know what you got. I will be interested to see how that all balances out. And on a personal update, I have started playing the video game Hades. This has nothing to do with Percy Jackson other than it's also based in Greek mythology. And I just wanted to mention this because it's based in Greek mythology and maybe you guys, you know, like playing video games and haven't picked this up yet. It's a lot of fun, but it's so weird playing that and reading Percy Jackson at the same time because it's all the same characters. I put that in air quotes. But they are very, very different, like, people.
Yeah. When I walked in here last night and saw House of Hades at the top of the screen, I went, "Bleh?" And then realized that it was a, you know, like, Greek mythology video game, but was not Percy related. Because it took me a minute. I was like, wait a minute. Yeah. That's a Percy thing. No, it's not. It's a Greek thing that, of course, showed up in Percy. But yeah. So I had to, like, adjust my
thinking. Yeah. You play as Zagreus, who is Hades' son, and he's trying to escape the underworld, basically.
That's a name,
yeah,
man.
Yeah.
I like it.
But it's so funny because, like, the Poseidon in this game, I feel like, is very different from the Poseidon in Percy Jackson. And so every time he comes on, I was like, you're not the right Poseidon. Because my loyalty stays with Percy Jackson.
Always.
Yeah. Okay, so not a lot of news and updates today, which is okay because I am very excited to get into our main discussion for today. Now, this was Kristen's idea, and as soon as she said it, I was like, we have to do this. So you want to basically explain the premise of what we're going to be doing here.
Well, basically, if you've seen the Disney Plus series What If, which is based in the Marvel Universe, you know that those were little, like, one-shots of, you know, what if one thing changed in the Marvel Universe, and how would that affect other things going forward? I'm trying to think of specific examples. The very first one was Peggy Carter stepping into the machine to become a super soldier instead of Steve, just because something happens, Steve got shot, Peggy jumped in, you know. So instead of Captain America, we had Captain Carter, who had the Union Jack on her shield, and yeah. So it's a little fun way to kind of look at, like, these are obviously, you know, we have the books, we have the choices the author made, but, like, what if this was what they chose, or what if this happened in the universe instead of this? And so it's just a fun way to look at alternate universes for the Percy universe.
It's a nice little, like, mind exercise, and also really makes you think about, if this one thing changed, how much would that change down the line, which is often very complicated to think about. But I'm pretty excited at what we're going to talk about today. So I will start us off, and mine is a little bit more of a general one. So mine is, what if demigods weren't claimed until they were 18? So demigods can get claimed at all different ages in the Percy Jackson books. But what if they were off the radar until they were 18? And basically, this is my excuse to have a darker, more adult series. And if anybody out there knows of a Greek gods, like, I know you have a couple of suggestions, but just Greek gods stories where it's kind of like Percy Jackson, but it's more adult, I would definitely be interested in reading those. Yeah, I thought this could be really interesting because it would actually change the whole tone of the series, and it would change a lot of what we saw happen. Rick doesn't really shy away from the reality of the Greek myths. Like, we know that the gods cheated on each other, they killed each other. Like, it is pretty brutal in a lot of ways, even if it's kind of covered up by a little bit of a sillier middle grade tone. But I think the tales in the stories would be a lot more graphic and intense, and what Percy has to do would kind of weigh on his shoulders a little bit more. And I think, like, just him being in the adult world having to deal with this stuff would be really interesting. And even though, like, he might have had a slightly better childhood because he wouldn't have been shipped off to Camp Half-Blood at 12 years old. I say shipped off like his mother wanted to get rid of him. No, obviously not. But, like, he wouldn't have gone to Camp Half-Blood at 12, so he would have had a quote-unquote more normal childhood. But I think it would have been hard for him to stay in school, and I think he'd be a bit of a mess, but he would be making adult mistakes at that point, and that could really change a lot of stuff.
I wonder how how the human parents would react to that. Like, obviously Sally would know that he's Poseidon's kid, but do you tell him that? What age do you tell him that?
Maybe, like, she's waiting till he's 18.
Right, and if you wait till they're 18, like, you know, that's quite the bomb to drop on a kid. Even, I mean, at 18 you're not a kid, but you are a kid.
Yeah.
So, like, you know, hey, by the way, you're actually a demigod and your powers are going to kick in any moment now, so just be ready. You know, like, that's a lot. Or do you tell them when they're 6 years old? Like, hey, you know, I'm going to, you know, mentally prepare you. This is why your dad's not around. And at least if the monsters weren't aware of them until they're 18, and, like, if they had some time to be a kid, I feel like at least then they would have gotten to enjoy their childhood, even if school's hard, even, you know, because I can understand that not everything is easy, you know, like it's not too bad. But at least then they'd be able to be kids. Mm-hmm. Like, I feel bad that demigods don't choose their parentage, but they lose out on being children, really, because they have to run off and away from their parents and away from any, you know, completely human siblings they may have, because otherwise they could bring terror, death, destruction, you know, down on people they love, so.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's a good point, and I think that would be kind of down to parenting style, whether or not they would tell them beforehand to prepare them and how that could mess them up, and, like, do they believe their parent? Do they think their parent's crazy? Because there's not going to be any evidence. They're not going to have powers before they turn 18 necessarily, depending on how it's written. So, yeah, I really like the idea of imagining, like, an adult Percy Jackson trying to navigate the same things that he was trying to navigate here, like losing his mother at 18 versus losing your mother at 12. It's still going to be awful, but have a slightly different effect. Is he going to be a lot more headstrong? Is he going to be more set in his ways, less willing to listen to other people, less willing to listen to Annabeth? You know, so that's 6 years difference between then and now. And if he had a completely normal childhood, that's going to cement a bit more of your personality. So you kind of don't really know how Percy would have turned out without everything that happened to him at 12.
It's very interesting.
It is. Yeah. Kristen, what's your first what-if scenario?
Okay, so mine is, what if Sally and Poseidon had a second child, maybe a sister?
Okay.
So Percy has a full sibling.
Yes.
Because we know that he has half siblings. We've met a few of them.
Yeah.
But a full sibling, how would that change Percy's story? Whether he and this sibling are just a few years apart, so maybe 4 or 5 years apart, where it could affect Percy's childhood, it could affect how old he is when he gets to Camp Half-Blood. Maybe he doesn't make it to 12. Like, maybe he, like Annabeth, has to leave early because two children, two, you know, demigods in one household is going to attract a lot of trouble. And I don't think there's any significant other, Gabe or anyone, who could hide two kids worth of trouble. So, like,
oh my God.
Yeah, right? Gabe. Right? Gabe 2.0, like, two, yeah. You know, two Gabes, like,
twice
no, thank
as
you.
Smelly.
Yeah, no, that would be so gross. So, like, you know, I'm curious if, like, if Percy has to go to Camp Half-Blood at age 7, how does that change, you know, if he and Annabeth are there together and she's not alone and, you know, maybe they don't go on any quests until later on in their childhood, like, once they've been claimed or all, you know, once Percy's been claimed, if he waits till 12 or 14 or whatever. I just feel like that could be a really interesting dilemma for both the series in general and Percy, because if they were really close in age, it would affect his childhood. If, let's say, Poseidon and Sally had a child now, it could also change Percy's story going forward. Mm-hmm. Like, would him and Annabeth stay at Camp Jupiter or New Rome University? Sorry. My bad. Like, would they stay there? Or would Percy consider coming back to Camp Half-Blood to be there for his sibling, to help them through it? You know, like, it could definitely change a few things.
Yeah. Can you imagine how mad the other gods would have been, too, if not only did Poseidon break the treaty once, but, like, a few years later broke it again?
I mean,
they'd be like, come on, man.
That's the other thing. Like, oh, by the way, I didn't just do it once. I have a second secret child, my bad.
Yeah.
Sally's just really pretty and really sweet, and I like her a lot.
She makes the best cookies. I just can't resist them.
Yeah, so just one of those things where I really can see Percy trying to be the protective older brother, whether it's a sister or a brother, to be honest.
Yeah.
I can see him, like looking at Annabeth and being like, I need to be there for them, mm-hmm. you know. And honestly, I can't see Annabeth making him choose or anything crazy like that. I think she would be like, yeah, let's go.
Yeah.
And maybe they become counselors at camp. Maybe they take on a leadership role. Maybe Chiron takes some time off and goes and does some modern-day adventuring. Who knows? But I think it could have an interesting an interesting story. And I mean, I'm not saying that this could be a whole new book series, Rick, if you're listening. Just kidding. No, but like, I mean, it could be a whole new way to kind of tell another Camp Half-Blood tale, including, you know, making it possible for previous characters to show up, but not necessarily forcing them to either. Mm-hmm. Percy and Annabeth could still stay at New Rome, and maybe he's just in constant contact via Iris message, or maybe not, you know, just there for them when they need him. And maybe this demigod sibling has to do new adventures of their own, or, you know, like, it could be a really fun way to keep the world alive, but not having to necessarily dive back into telling stories we've already heard, or getting back to characters that have already had their chance in the spotlight.
Yeah. I really like the idea of imagining that Percy had a sibling that was only a couple years younger than him, and thinking about him going to Camp Half-Blood with her or him, and like, yeah, you're right, like being the protective older brother, and how that would have changed him going off on quests, and whether or not the younger sibling was used as bait, as they often are. And then from the younger sibling's perspective, you know, living in the shadow of their older brother, who is this very famous, successful demigod, and what that has to mean for them coming into their own powers and maybe not living up to standards, or maybe even surpassing the standards, and how crazy that could be. There's a whole bunch of directions this could go in.
Plus, when you get into the Poseidon of it all, like, Poseidon dotes on Percy and, you know, is really proud of his son. If you have two kids that are, you know, in the same family, how do you treat them equally? Does he still, like, dote on Percy the way he does? Maybe the second child feels a little more left out, or mm-hmm. maybe he does try to give them both the same amount of attention, and so maybe Percy feels slighted because he's the older one and didn't get more attention. You know what I mean? Like, there's all kinds of drama and crazy things yeah. going on. So,
because you don't even have to take in the supernatural element of it all for there to be great conflict and tension between an older brother and a younger sibling, and what it feels like to have the responsibility of the older one, or to feel like you're always living in the older one's shadows. And yeah, there's going to be like a weird dynamic between the two of them just because their life is insane.
Yeah.
And then having to navigate that. Like, I really like familial stories, both the kind that deal with, like, siblings, because I'm an only child, so, like, I've always found that really interesting. You know, how they navigate their relationships and whether they're close or not, and how you repair issues between each other, but also, like, found family and all the other campers and how they would react to both of these siblings and if one liked one more than the other and stuff like that. So there's just, like, an endless array of possibilities here.
Yeah. Just an interesting situation to consider.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay, so now Karen gets to give us her second idea.
Yes, and this is the one that we both independently thought of, right? But yes. I got it in the doc first.
Yes.
So that's cool. I think this is a really good one because it's basically, what if Talia made it to Camp Half-Blood? So what if she got into Camp Half-Blood, didn't turn into the tree, that whole thing? Okay, so first and foremost, Luke and Talia would probably still be in a relationship because there were hints that they were kind of romantically involved. Does that mean that he wouldn't have betrayed everyone? I would kind of think that he wouldn't have, because he would have had an outlet with her to be able to talk about what was bothering him.
Or would Talia have chosen Luke's side?
Yeah, I mean, also a possibility.
That would, I mean, talk about a formidable, like, pair.
Yeah.
If Talia and Luke were both fighting on Cronus's side, like, that would have been kind of insane.
It would have been a lot. Yeah, and I think the thing that really interests me with this idea is that it almost would have been that Talia would have been, like, the main character of the story, because she would have been the first big three demigod to make it to camp. She kind of would have outshone Percy when he finally showed up, because he showed up as the first one to actually make it to camp. And basically, when Percy shows up, you know, they kind of, I would like to think, would have been like instant allies because they're both subjects of this prophecy. They're both kind of outsiders in the fact that they're big three demigods. And I think it would have been nice to see her immediately take him under her wing and how that would have affected her relationship with Luke, how that would have steered him in a certain direction. Would he have become such good friends with Annabeth if he had Talia to rely on from the beginning?
Well, because the other option is Percy shows up, Talia's thought all this time that the prophecy was about her, and she was just basically waiting for things to start kicking into gear, and Percy shows up and all of a sudden things kick into gear. Does she become competitive?
Yeah.
Like, no, I'm a daughter of Zeus. I deserve to be the subject of this prophecy. Like,
yeah.
Who is this numbskull who shows up? Like, no. Like, I can see her kind of being competitive about it. Like, I'm definitely the subject of this prophecy, Percy Jackson, and you are not going to steal my adventure. Like, I can totally see Talia being like
she's
that.
She's pretty spunky, so I wouldn't be surprised. I would like to think that, you know, they would be better working together, but also that is less interesting than them having this, like, crazy rivalry.
I mean, I would definitely be down for a Talia-Percy, like, team-up. Like, that would be so cool, but I don't know. It could have gone either way, I will say. I think there is a possibility that she's like, oh, thank goodness, it's not just me. You know, I have someone else who's kind of in the same boat, like, let's work together. Or it could be, Hexnaw, this is mine.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. The other possibility here is that before she made it to Camp Half-Blood, she did run into the Hunters of Artemis, and she almost joined it. Zoe Nightshade also almost convinced her to join the Hunters. And so maybe once they made it to camp, like, she didn't join the Hunters because of Luke. Like, she wanted to stay with Luke. So once she joined camp, would she have changed her mind if everything had worked out? If maybe it would have, like, weighed on her a bit more and she would decide to join the Hunters? This would have removed her as a subject of the prophecy like it did for Bianca. So it kind of would have fell back onto Percy's shoulders. But I think it would have been interesting to see Talia become a hunter much sooner, and then how that would have affected Luke's storyline. So maybe that would have reverted him back to his pathway because he lost his girlfriend, he was alone now, and everything that he had been thinking of beforehand, or like in our version of the story, kind of would have came to be again.
It's interesting to think about.
Speaking
of Luke.
Oh, Luke.
What if Luke was able to resist Kronos' manipulations, so he never turns evil. Well, evil. Quote-unquote evil. Because he's not really evil, but
misguided.
Yes, and like, if Luke never turns against the, you know, the Greek god cause, the Camp Half-Blood cause, Percy's cause, whatever cause you want to call it, would Annabeth have still bonded with Percy as much as she did? Would she still have been, you know, had interest in Percy if Luke is giving her the time of day, if he's not distracted by Kronos and Kronos, you know, trying to use him and giving him, you know, tasks to complete and master bolts to steal and, you know, all that stuff? How would that affect Percy and Annabeth's relationship later on? Annabeth clearly had feelings for Luke, and in the story, Luke is so distracted that, like, I don't think he had time to really even contemplate it, because by the end, Luke kind of reaches out to Annabeth, and, like, without straight up asking her, like, you know, could you have liked me, you know, could I have been the one for you, or whatever, it's more like, just like, did I have a chance kind of thing. And, you know, she kind of has already been burned by him at that point, so it's like, no. But she definitely had interest in Luke, and she definitely, you know, felt bad for everything that had to go down the way it did, and she felt guilty over having to be the one to do it and all of that jazz. So, like, I just feel like that could have complicated the story in really crazy and interesting ways if Luke hadn't gone dark.
Yeah, I think trying to figure out what their relationship would have been like is a really interesting question, because I always got the sense from Luke that he saw Annabeth as a little sister and didn't necessarily have any feelings for her or anything. So I don't think that they necessarily would have gotten together, but it 100% would have delayed her relationship with Percy. And I'm curious, like, I would still like to think that they would have gotten together eventually, but would Luke have always been something that kind of, like, came in between them? You know, I could see Percy being a little jealous of having Luke around, but also looking up to Luke because he was such, like, you know, a cool demigod camp counselor kind of person.
Well, and Percy is a Luke fan.
So. Exactly. So I think that, yeah, it would have delayed things, and I think that what they had gone through, specifically because of everything Luke had put them through, helped solidify their relationship. So it would look really different if Luke hadn't done all of that.
Yeah. Another thing that just kind of, you know, when you start thinking about, okay, if Luke never really goes dark and he's, you know, a full-blown camper and is there to help and all of that, would he have been a help or a hindrance on quests? Like, could he have been the third in, you know, the big prophecy quest? Like, would it have been Percy, Annabeth, and Luke instead of Grover? What would that have looked like? You know, how would that have changed the challenges they came across? You know, because Grover's a pretty big help at least a couple of times throughout throughout Lightning Thief as we're reading now. So, like, you know, that definitely could change a few things.
Yeah, I think that's really cool because Luke, as the son of Hermes, has abilities that the others don't, obviously. And, like, children of Hermes are tricky and they're smart and they know how to get things done. So I feel like he would have been a huge help, maybe a distraction to Annabeth. But I think having his abilities on quests and stuff, because he's also a fantastic fighter and he's older, so he's a little more experienced, I think he would have been a huge help. And it's almost sad now that we never got to saw what that would have been like.
But somebody would have probably had to have taken Luke's place in Kronos' plan, and that's something I don't necessarily want to think about. Yeah. Like, I mean, I don't even want to think about it, but, like, Annabeth, could she have been tricked?
Yeah.
You know, especially with her relationship with her father, if Kronos would have used that against her, like, could she have been one that was kind of lured to that side? Or, you know, would it had to have been, you know, someone of Luke's lineage because of his connections to Kronos and all of that, too? You know, it's just interesting how that may have changed somebody else's story if they got subbed into Luke's spot, because Kronos needed someone powerful and with connections at camp to kind of get things done. And
I don't think Annabeth would, but what about Clarice?
Definitely a possibility.
Because, I mean, she loves war. She's always fighting with everybody. Like, I feel like he could have twisted that in her mind to think that, oh, this will be your glorious battle. This will be a way to prove yourself to your father. Like,
I mean,
she would have been a lot more manipulative. Bull. That's not a word.
More easily manipulated.
More easily manipulated. I'm a writer for a living. I do that for a job. People pay me for it.
Ooh.
I don't think they should.
And the last little question that came to my mind was, would the gods have continued to resist claiming their children since it was Luke's dying wish that Percy request that the gods claim their kids? And so Percy puts it to the gods.
Okay.
Like, puts it to the gods and said, don't let this happen again. Like, you need to claim your children. It, you know, it will solve a lot of problems. And because it was Luke's dying wish, like, if he's never dying, you know, like, if he doesn't die until later in his life, how long would that have gone on?
Yeah.
Whose life would it have complicated? How many children would have gone without knowing who their godly parent is?
Mm-hmm.
Definitely could change some stuff.
Yeah, for sure. Because that's kind of the big thing of the series is just that, you know, the gods are absent parents and they need to step up their game. And like you said, if somebody else had taken Luke's place, they probably would have had similar feelings. So if it was Clarice instead, maybe it wasn't about claiming, but maybe it was just about, you know, paying more attention to them in general. I kind of feel like this would still pan out roughly the same way, but if it hadn't, that changes everything, really. I mean, that changes so much of what comes later in the later books, too. Okay, so those were our four main ideas between the two of us, but we've got a couple of bonus ideas, and a few of these come from our listeners, and I thought they were really good, and I definitely didn't want to go without mentioning them. The first one comes from at Colby_Jack_, which I love their name. It's very good. And they say, "What if Bianca survived Titan's curse?" So basically, what happens is in Titan's Curse, they go on a quest, and it's like Bianca, Grover, Talia, it was supposed to be Phoebe, and they decide not to go. So Bianca, Zoe, Grover, Talia, yeah, that's four. And then Percy ends up being the fifth in the prophecy when they thought it was going to be Phoebe. And they go to the junkyard, and basically she accidentally sets off one of Hephaestus's, like, automatons, Talos, and she's killed. And so somebody else would have had to have died during that quest. So you've got Zoe, Grover, Percy, and Talia. I would have chosen Zoe because she's the less important one, I think, out of everybody. But what if it had been Grover? That would have changed everything.
A lot,
yeah. That would change so much.
I mean, if, yeah.
Or if it had been Talia, like, having just gotten to camp or something.
I was just thinking the same thing. Or, like, just
being brought back to life and then dies almost immediately after.
Yeah.
Tragedy.
That would have been rough.
Percy? Oh. What if it was Percy? All right, end of the series.
Would have been a bait and switch. Like, by the way, this is called Percy Jackson, but he did.
Yeah.
So now it's the Talia story. Yeah. Let's go. You know.
Talia Grace and the Gods of Olympus.
The rest of the Gods of Olympus, yeah.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's kind of a big change right then and there. She would have still have been a hunter of Artemis. And this is the most interesting thing. I feel like this is going to hit you personally right in the feels. We wouldn't have gotten Hazel because, because Nico was mad at Percy for Bianca's death. And he went searching for her in the underworld and realized that he couldn't bring her back or shouldn't bring her back. And so he brought back Hazel instead as his half-sibling. But he was in the underworld searching for Bianca. So if he never had to go to the underworld to search for Bianca, we never would have gotten Hazel. It's a sad world, isn't it?
Hazel.
Yeah.
So, that would have been, oh, I don't like that.
Yeah. See, this is what makes these kind of conversations so interesting. Cause you go, oh, Nico's sister wouldn't have died. That's a good thing. But then you realize what you don't get because she died.
Right. The prophecy still has to be completed, so someone else has to die, and if someone else dies, it could affect everything.
Yeah.
And just the fact that she doesn't die means that Nico doesn't have to do this stuff, so then it means that someone else, you know, it's crazy how much it snowballs and just changes all kinds of people's lives.
Yeah, it's really interesting.
Yeah.
What's your bonus one?
So, this is, like, not a fully formed idea, but what if electronics didn't attract monsters, and the demigods had ample access to the internet and technology and all of that at Camp Half-Blood?
Their lives would be so much easier. Oh my god.
Like, I can see why Rick made it the way he did.
Yeah.
Because it forces them to learn a lot on the fly, and they don't have time to just Google it and look it up and be like, oh, duh, this is definitely where the entrance to the underworld is, or I can easily figure it out on demigod.net or whatever. it would have to be on the dark web with, like, 13 passwords or something to get in, or, you know, something crazy like that. But for some reason, out of all the things that my brain could have come up
this
with...
This is the youest thing you could have put down here.
Of all the things that my brain could have come up with regarding electronics and the internet, this is the thing, the question I most wanted to answer. What movie nights would Camp Half-Blood have had with the screen clearly up on the back of the climbing wall? And, like, I can imagine they make, like, you know, little, like, couches or, like, beanbags or something, and they pull them up, and they all have movie night. what movies are they watching? Like, that seems fascinating to me. Like, and what would watching, like, Princess Bride or what? How Lord of the Rings, how would that affect them as, like, adventurers? Like,
yeah,
all of that. Because movies are so important to my brain and myself that, like, I can't imagine a Percy who doesn't know about, like, Lord of the Rings and hasn't seen Samwise Gamgee and, like, Grover, I can see, like, you know, loving the hobbits yeah. because they're so, like, you know, obsessed with nature and food and, like, all of that. So I can just, you know, I just think it would be so much fun.
Yeah. I had two immediate thoughts when I read this. One, School of Rock. I don't know why, but I feel like they would enjoy School of Rock so much.
I can see, like, Kyron being a fan or something. You know what I mean? Like,
and Mr. D is so annoyed that everybody just wants to play instruments now and all the satyrs are going around like,
with their,
you know,
pan flutes.
Yeah, exactly. My other thought was DC movies, specifically because I want to know Percy's reaction to Aquaman.
Oh, God.
He would be so mad,
oh,
I think.
Oh, gosh. That would be amazing. Like, I can't... Like, okay, I can talk to animal, like, I can talk to horses, and I can talk to underwater creatures, but, like, not like that. Or, you know,
he would, like, either be really judgmental, or he would think that, like, Jason Momoa is the coolest person on the, and then he'd want to be just like him.
He'd grow his hair out. And Annabeth's like, why are you, like, Percy, your hair's getting kind of long. I know. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Percy, why do you have a tattoo on your arm? Don't worry about it. Like slowly but surely, he's turning into the wild man that Jason Momoa is. Yeah. And Annabeth's just
starts
like...
starts growing a beard, but it's all, like, patchy.
Right,
and
Annabeth's
can't,
like,
grow one.
Dude, you can't be Jason Momoa. No one can be Jason Momoa. Like, stop trying.
But what if he starts bulking up and grows a beard and long hair? Oh, man.
Aw,
what if Annabeth's just like, yes, keep doing that. This is good.
Like, I'm down. All right. Yeah. No, I think it would be really funny. I would love to see his reaction to Aquaman and the theory of that Aquaman came from Atlantis and, like, all of that stuff. Like, all the, you know, the mythology there. Like Atlantis. How far-fetched an idea is that? Like, I can see him kind of, like, joking around about it. Like, it's not
bad. Or all... they start watching movies based on Greek mythology, and Chiron makes them write essays about, like, what they got wrong and why it's wrong and all of that, and it turns movie night into, like, a homework assignment.
Into school, yeah.
And everyone's upset. That would be... This is so funny. I love this. I was thinking, too, like, going back to just the electronics part of it, like, yes, it would make their lives a lot easier, but I also kind of want to... Like you said, if they had a dark web, like, what would it be like if the gods were able to be on the internet and put that information out there, like, go to the chat boards to get your quest or something like that.
Oh, geez.
And, like, it would really change a lot. And I haven't watched American Gods, but I know that, like, mythology is wrapped up in American Gods, and there's a god of, like, technology and stuff. And just, like, trying to imagine what that would be like, incorporating that into the Percy Jackson universe, like, how it would make things easier, but also, like, obviously, the internet also makes things way more complicated. Or if they were able to talk to demigods around the world and, like...
Or what if, like, instead of, like, iris messages being what they are, like, if iris was able to take on technology as a communication form or something?
Yeah.
So, like, there's, like, an iris net or something that isn't the internet, but it's, like, the Greek gods version of the internet. Like, I could see something like that being cool too.
And what if that was, like, insulated so the monsters couldn't, so you have to, like, be logged into IrisNet to communicate, and if you try to do it outside of that, then the monsters can sense you.
Right? That would be cool. That would be fun.
Our minds are just spinning now.
So many possibilities.
Yeah. Okay, so our last little bonus what-if scenario is kind of a two-for-one. These are related. The first one came from at Hi I Write Fanfic, who said, what if Percy went to the dark side? And the idea was fleshed out a little bit more in at Griffin_B1893's tweet, where they said, what if Luke and Kronos had gotten to Percy first and convinced him to join their side because he wouldn't have really known anyone else, maybe including how others would follow alongside, aka Annabeth, Talia, Nico, and Bianca potentially, and Percy's role in the Titan army. And I think this actually goes back to your scenario about Luke. And so if Luke hadn't been part of the Minotaur manipulations. What if it had been Percy instead, and how that could have changed literally everything? And I think you could still make a hero journey out of that story. Like, it's not necessarily that he was evil, but that Kronos got to him first. He was manipulated, and then maybe Annabeth, Grover, and them, like, come to rescue him, and everything he thought was true isn't, and they have to, like, show him what the real world is like.
And Annabeth gets her own quest.
Yeah.
Like, rather than the child of the big three showing up at Camp Half-Blood, the child of the big three shows up at Camp Half-Blood, and Kronos immediately gets to them. And Percy leaves to go try and steal the bolt or whatever. And Annabeth gets her solo quest. So her and Grover and insert third person here, Clarice.
Yeah.
Who knows?
Some random.
Go like... off on a quest to find Percy and bring him back. Like, I could see that totally being a thing.
Yeah.
Annabeth would have been so excited.
I know. She would have. And I think, I really, really love this scenario because it still puts Percy in a position to do a lot of what he did later on, but, like, immediately going over to Cronus' side and thinking, okay, this is the good guy, everybody else is against him, he's just trying to do this thing, set us free, or something like that, and Annabeth waltzes in and is like, nope, everything you thought is wrong, and then their relationship from there, where they go basically from antagonists to, hey, maybe we can trust each other. Like, you, Percy, have a lot of power and a lot of potential. And let me show you what your life really could be like. And he's open to that possibility. And then, actually, this reminds me a lot of Trials of Apollo, when Meg has to work against, what's his face, the Roman emperor, who's like her dad. Nero?
Yeah,
it's Nero. Basically, she has to fight against everything that he taught her, and she's brainwashed. She's been mentally and emotionally abused, and she learns to kind of stand on her own two feet, and she ends up helping Apollo because it's the right thing to do. Basically, that would have been Percy's whole shtick, and that would have been really cool. And would Sally have not gone to the underworld, you know? Or she'd have to be out of the way somehow anyway, because she probably would have tried to convince him that... So probably Sally would still be going to the underworld. And then Kronos could pit Percy against Hades and the other gods for, like, taking her away. Like, I still think it would, like, really fit into the story to do it this way.
It would definitely have been a very interesting...
Yeah.
Different story, but very interesting nonetheless.
Yeah. Okay, that was fun.
Yeah.
That was really cool to think about those things. If you guys have any other suggestions for us, please let us know. We can either, like, tweet about them or do another episode like this if we get a bunch more suggestions. Or, I don't know, write something on Subjectify. Making no promises there. But I just think it'd be really cool to think about the multiverse, the Percy Jackson multiverse, because I'm obsessed with multiverses. And hey, technically the multiverse does exist because of Rick Riordan Presents. So there are different realities in which all of these things have come to pass.
Boom.
Just saying.
It's all true.
Yeah. Okay, but for now,
it's not what if, it's where and when if.
Yes.
Dun, dun, dun.
That is true. That is good. But for now, we're sticking to canon, so let's discuss our chapter reviews for this week.
Okay, so this week we read chapters 17 and 18, and we will start our discussion with chapter 17, entitled We Shop for Waterbeds. So, in this chapter, thanks to the Lotus Casino, the trio can afford to take a cab all the way to L.A., from Las Vegas, because, yeah, that's where they left. First stop is the Santa Monica Pier, where Percy takes a dip and meets the Naiad that he talked to in the Mississippi. She gives him a gift from his father, a few pearls that he should smash when in need of them. Annabeth warns Percy that no gift comes without a price, so he should probably be extra careful with those and only use them in case of a real emergency. They then catch a bus and head to West Hollywood, and after a bit of wandering, the trio ducks into Krusty's waterbed palace and finds himself in a spot of trouble. Percy's quick thinking helps them escape and find DOA Recording Studio, aka the entrance to the underworld. At least the Lotus Casino provided them a comfy ride to L.A.?
How convenient. No, I think, like, in most stories, it would have been like, oh, how convenient that they happen to have all of this real money, blah, blah, blah. But I actually think, you know, this is really smart because it keeps the story moving and it makes their trip to the Lotus Casino not just like a random aside, like it had significant importance because it gave them the money. What I find most interesting here is that the money's real. Like, it's not just that they were giving them fake money to use within the casino to keep them there and it was basically endless because it was fake. No, this is real money that works outside of the casino, and I really want to know where this money comes from. Like, yeah. Like, how the Lotus Eaters, which basically made the hotel, like, how that just comes to
be. And it's, like, an infinity symbol shows up on the meter when they...
Yeah. Is, like, it part of the mist, maybe? So maybe it still is fake, but...
That could be.
Yeah.
That could be. But, like, it was a credit card that was read by the machine. Like, a completely unrelated machine read the card and said, this is worth as much as it needs to be.
Yeah.
Like, basically.
I thought that was really interesting.
Yeah, yeah. No, but at least, I do think that since time sped up so much and we went from having 5 whole days to get from Las Vegas to LA, like, since we now have, like, 24 hours to get the, you know, the Master Bolt back to Zeus or all this, you know, horrible stuff's about to happen, at least, you know, the least Rick could do is give the trio a way to get to LA. Like, okay, I've made your lives miserable now. You have 1 whole day to get all of this stuff done. At least you can have a comfy ride to LA.
Yeah, exactly. And you've been from LA to Vegas, right?
Yes.
Yeah, so, and that was like 4 hours?
I want to say somewhere around there, yeah.
Yeah, so imagine a 4-hour taxi ride.
I mean...
That is expensive.
Yeah. That would be really expensive.
Yeah.
But at least they had a chance to, like... maybe sleep and talk and relax.
And they were going 95, so maybe it was less than
like
4 hours.
3 hours.
Yeah.
3.5. I don't know.
Yeah. I really enjoyed the water scene in this chapter. I think it's cool that he just walked into the water and he was like, yeah, we're just going to try this again. And I like how he described having trouble letting go of, like, holding his breath, but then everything turned out fine anyway. And I know that a couple of episodes ago we were having a conversation about this. So she's not a naiad, she's a nereid, which is the saltwater version of the naiad. They're basically her freshwater cousins. And I thought it was really interesting that she says, they honor Lord Poseidon, but do not serve in his court, which kind of goes back to what we were wondering before about how Poseidon basically has, like, control over all water and everything, but salt water and the sea is, like, his domain. And while he might have influence and, you know, the naiads and stuff might pray to him and, like, accept his patronage and stuff, it's not quite, like... He's not there all the time like he is in the sea, basically.
Which makes sense.
Yeah, it does.
I mean, freshwater and saltwater are kind of different. They're similar. They're both water. But, like, I can see why they might have different godly patrons and all that for the different spirits and all of that. I mean, it makes sense. As much as anything makes sense. It makes
sense. It does. It totally makes 100% sense.
I wanted to just take a brief second to talk about these pearls.
Okay.
Because I did not remember these. I don't know if it's just that it's been so long since I've read Percy that, like, this one little detail has just exited my brain. But, I don't necessarily want to be spoiled, even though I've read this book and I know what happens. Like, I'm trying to remember if these come in handy, like...
They are a huge part of the ending.
What did I do?
I don't know.
Where am I? Why do I not remember any of this?
Yeah. I was actually really excited when the pearls showed up because this is one of my favorite elements to this story.
Okay.
It's hugely significant. That's so funny.
Why has my brain blocked this out?
Well, it'll be really satisfying when you read it again, because you'll probably remember, and you'll probably also go, oh yeah, that's so amazing. So.
If anyone else is on my team and does not remember what has happened, and has clearly been way too long since they read Percy Jackson and the Lightning Thief, don't worry, it's okay. We all have short-term memory problems.
Yeah. Also, we've both read like 15 books in this series. There's a lot of details to keep up in your head.
It's true. Yeah. It's true. For some reason, I have a blank spot where these pearls are, and I do not remember what is going on.
It's going to be great when you find out.
But I'm with Annabeth, though. Nothing comes without a price, especially in the world of the Greek gods. So Percy needs to be extra careful with how he uses these things. So, you know, we'll just leave it at that for now. I also, just because I'm me, what do you think Annabeth and Grover were up to while Percy was just chilling underwater at the pier, just, like, hanging out?
Yeah.
I like to think about these random things. Like,
yeah.
Were they just, like, chatting?
Probably. Or
were they talking about, like, okay, so we have to find DOA. Where should we start looking? Like, any ideas? It's a recording studio. Is there
Grover
a music
Grover was probably
district?
Panicking. And Annabeth spent the entire time trying to calm him down.
Grover's digging for, like, tin cans and stuff. Like, he's just, like, randomly... Maybe he comes across somebody with a metal detector and is like... everything is a what that? If. Everything is what if.
Yeah, I know. Now I can't get my head out
of
that.
He's following somebody with a metal detector, and anytime they, like, dig up something that's not jewelry or whatever and they just kind of toss it, he, like, runs after it and eats it because he's Grover and eats tin cans. Anyway.
Okay. Yeah, my favorite little moment of the chapter was Smelly Gabe talking to Barbara Walters.
Oh my God.
It was so funny. And, like, the Barbara Walters voice, like, the way that he wrote her, I could just hear it. It was perfect.
Yeah, and, like, her saying, like, is this Percy really, a misguided teen, or is he evil, or is he
a terrorist?
Right? Like, I can hear Barbara Walters, and this is 2020. Like, I could totally hear her doing that.
Yeah.
So, it's really funny.
It was really...
Love it.
It was great. Yeah. Poor Percy is having a rough time, though. Like, not only is... there's this whole, like, hunt going on for him, so he's got to be careful of that. But all of these monsters and stuff that he's coming up against, still, you know, let's remember, only having been in this world for, like, a week, 2 weeks, maybe? Like, it has not been very long. But he goes to the Krusty's waterbed palace, and he has to chop the guy's head off, and I'm just saying, he did that with very little hesitation. Granted, he specifically said, like, I know this is a monster. If it was a person, it would be different, but this monster deserves to go back to the underworld, and he's really adjusted to this new life, like, fairly quickly.
Yeah. By the way, Krusty is actually Procrusty's?
Yeah.
Procrustes. Procrusty's?
I think... Yeah, probably.
Which I've never heard of.
No.
Interesting. Just another monster name thrown out there.
Yeah.
Kind of creepy.
He was probably right to call himself Krusty's, although very disgusting.
Ew.
He was not a good-looking man either.
Also, yes, I was a little thrown that Grover and Annabeth didn't see the reptilian skin or whatever that Percy sees when he walks in, and they're just like, you know, and Grover's like, yeah, I want to jump on the bed, and, you know, like, Annabeth's not quite as enthusiastic about that. She's more forced into it by Krusty.
Yeah.
But, like, hello, clearly a monster, like, not a human. Like, Percy kind of gets that impression quickly, like, this guy's not normal.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, he doesn't stop Grover, which might have been the better option. but still, like, I was a little shocked that they weren't a little more suspicious of this dude.
Yeah. A lot's been going on. My last question here is, do you think DOA recording studios would be interested in sponsoring Prophecy Radio?
Now 10 million undead served.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, Because if they're dead, but they haven't gone to the underworld yet, are they dead? Because they're hanging out in purgatory.
Think of how many subscribers we could have.
Would Charon be like a listener? Like, would he care?
Maybe. Maybe he would play it instead of his music.
Like, instead of the easy listening channel?
Yeah. He probably wouldn't. He loves his easy listening too much.
He does. He gets pissed.
Yeah. I mean, we might have to get paid in like gold drachmas.
I mean,
would they pay us or would we pay them?
I like gold. Isn't that from Pocahontas? Yeah, oh, no, that's... I like gruel.
Yes, yeah, yeah.
But same basic concept, yeah. And gold would definitely... He could have said, I like gold in that movie, too. I'm just saying.
Yeah. I just want them to fund us and make... We would be the most popular podcast in all of the land. All of the lands.
Agreed.
If they sponsored us. So, please... DOA Recording Studios, if you're listening to this.
Completely fictional DOA Recording Studios. Please consider your sponsorship of our podcast. Thank you. Yes,
I will take it in the form of gold drachmas.
I'm done.
They would be worth money here.
I was going to say, it's still gold.
Yeah.
You can still get
ancient
the gold.
Ancient artifacts can sell.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway.
Just a slight tangent. It's okay. Let's get into our favorite quotes from this chapter. I think I'll go first. Why not?
Okay, fine. Just kidding.
Okay. Don't mind us. Okay, so my favorite quote comes from the Nereid, who's in the waters out, you know, just off the Santa Monica Pier, where Percy's talking to her. And she says, "The oracles have foretold a great and terrible future for you, if you should survive to manhood." And this just made me, like, think, is there supposed to be more for Percy to do?
That's what I said. That's what I actually didn't see your quote earlier, and I put it in my notes section because I wanted to talk about it, and then I saw that it was your quote, so I figured I'd just talk about it then. But I had the exact same thought. Like, does that mean once he turns 18, like, that's when it really starts?
Right? Like, that's when stuff really gets bad. Yeah. Like, that, you know, you thought all of this was rough.
Yeah.
Wait till you get to manhood, Percy Jackson. Yeah, that it just stuck out at me because I'm like, wait, if you should survive to manhood,
yeah.
Like, they've all been talking about him being lucky to survive to 12 and him being lucky if he makes it past 16 and, like,
yeah.
All that stuff. Here, the oracles have already foretold a great and terrible future if he were to make it to actually being a full-fledged adult. So I'm curious if, like... Rick didn't mean to say this.
Yeah.
Like, he didn't mean to hint that there's an entire terrible future for Percy, or maybe he has this fantastic adult series planned in which Percy is, like, 40 and going on a quest or something. Like, wouldn't that be hilarious?
Yeah,
like,
it would be.
I would still read it. I would still be very into that. But yeah, just stuck out at me because of the manhood thing. I was like, wow. He has a lot of chaos planned. You know, the oracles have a lot of chaos planned for Percy, even past this book.
Yeah. Random question.
Mm-hmm.
What's the oldest demigod we've met? Because there are a few... I'm trying to thinking if Trials of Apollo, if we met some older ones. But a lot of them were, like, not monsters, but, like, creatures of some sort.
Yeah. It's like, we do meet Hercules eventually, but by then he's a god.
Yeah, I think so.
I was trying to think of any other.
Okay, so, yeah, this is what I thought. Josephine is a Greek demigod, daughter of Hecate, and a retired hunter of Artemis. She was one half of the lesbian couple in Trials of Apollo that took them in, and she's the way station.
Okay.
So I don't know how old she's meant to be, but she has gray hair, so she is a bit older. But I was just thinking, like, we don't see a whole lot of adult demigods because so many of them are killed as teenagers because of everything they have to go through. So there probably aren't a whole lot of them that are old enough to reach, like, manhood. I hate that we keep saying that word. It sounds gross for some reason, but...
It is a little weird.
Yeah, so that is so interesting. to think about what he would be doing at 30 or 40 or 50, you know?
Like, you think at some point the monsters would just get tired of hunting Percy and right? just move on to the other, you know, 100 demigod
Well, this
children.
Is a bust. Let's pick an easier target.
Right, like, okay, he made it to 40, now he gets an easy life from here on out. Yeah. You know, like, they just stop hunting you at 40 or something. Like, how, most demigods don't make it that far, so maybe there is an age where you stop being quite so smelly, delicious monsters.
This is old rotten food now.
Like, okay, at age 40, you magically stop being hunted or something. Like, it could, if being born, you suddenly smell great and monsters try and eat you, like...
This is the weirdest conversation.
Maybe there's an age at which you stop smelling delicious.
Yeah.
I'm just saying. It could be. We don't know because, again, there's like one demigod who made it past 17 or whatever.
Yeah. I will be interested in seeing how many exactly there are that we've met that are old enough like that. So
I wonder if Rick's considered that. Let us know.
No. Yeah.
Okay, so Karen, what was your favorite quote?
Mine is a piece of dialogue between Percy and Grover, and Percy just says, "You have evil thoughts for a goat." And Grover says, "Why, thank you." I don't know why, but it was just so funny.
I love them as friends, yeah, so they're great. I'm there for it.
I love that they have, like, a past, too. Like, it's before he realized he was a demigod, they were genuinely friends beforehand. And even though, like, I'm sure there's still a little bit of, like, you never told me. But they had a foundation beforehand. Instead of, like, it is between him and Annabeth, where they're still trying to figure things out. At least Percy and Grover kind of get each other already.
Well, and I think by this point in Lightning Thief, I think Percy doesn't seem to be harboring a lot of grudges about, you know, what happened before. I think he's kind of realized, like, if they had tried to tell me, I would have thought they were all on drugs. And there's no way I would have believed them. Yeah. Like, you know, so I think he kind of has made his peace. Like, they were doing what they thought was best. I believe in them. You know, Grover is my friend. He is the guy who was, you know, trying to help me and was a good friend to me. So, yeah, I do think that he's back to just thinking of Grover as his buddy. Okay, so then we're on to favorite moments. And for me, it's the cuddly shark.
You picked the best one. I love sharks.
I love sharks and I love the cuddly shark and the fact that it's a Mako and they are usually like super like huntery. Their eyes are really dark and they have like kind of a pointy nose. I know a lot about sharks because my brother and I loved watching like shark shows and shark movies and all that. It was before Shark Week, I'm saying. But we were like obsessed
with
sharks.
Are you getting hipster about sharks right now?
Yes. I'm claiming that I liked sharks before they were cool, okay? I definitely did. But no, we loved learning about sharks when we were kids. And so, like, yeah, I know what a Mako looks like because I'm like, yeah, I know the difference between that and a great white and I know the difference between that and a black-tipped reef shark and like all these others. So, yeah, I can like picture a Mako and I'm like, gosh, like, if that, like, rubbed up against my leg in the water, whether or not I'm a child of Poseidon, I'd be a little freaked, just like Percy was. So, like, I love that he's kind of freaked at first, and then it's like, oh, okay, it's being affectionate. It's like a dog. Like,
he was so cute.
I want a pet shark.
Yeah.
Like, I want Percy to have a pet shark.
That would be awesome.
It's really fun. But, yeah, and then I loved that the shark, like, ran off to play with the
seahorse.
The seahorse, yeah. That was cute, too.
Yeah, that is awesome.
Sorry to steal all the cute stuff.
That's okay. It was okay because I really loved when Percy tricks Krusty into showing him how great the bed is. Like, Percy is so clever, and I know we say this a lot, like, we're surprised, and it's not like I think Percy is dumb, because I don't, but I'm constantly surprised by how resourceful he is, because this is all still so brand new to him, and yet he's really thinking on his feet, and he's, like, taking charge of his own life, and, like, not being afraid, or at least working through the fear to make sure that he and his friends survive, and, like, not everybody can do that, so props to Percy.
Again, as you said, like, 5 minutes ago, he's only known about this for, like, 2 weeks or something. Like, who adjusts that quickly?
I wouldn't.
Only a 12-year-old, honestly, can kind of bounce back and say, okay, this is my new normal. I have to figure out a way to outsmart this crusty dude and, you know, save my friends' lives.
I'd still be hiding under my bed back at camp being like, I don't want to go on the quest. Send somebody else.
I could die? No, I'm not going on your quest. Like, yeah. Like, that would be more or less. Like, I don't do death option, like, possibilities? Like, no. Yeah. I'll stay here. Send somebody else. Yeah. I'm definitely a chicken. This is why I'm a Ravenclaw and not a Gryffindor. Anyway, moving on.
I am a Gryffindor, but I'm Neville Longbottom, so that actually does match up.
It does kind of work. All right. Yeah. All right. Okay, so that pretty much wraps up Chapter 17. If there's anything we missed or anything you specifically want to hear us talk about, feel free to send it to us in, you know, one of the myriad of ways. We'll be happy to read it. Let's move on to Chapter 18 now, entitled Annabeth Does Obedience School. The lobby of DOA Recording Studios is basically a purgatory of sorts, as tons of dead souls wait on Charon's mercy, or a drachma, to get them moved on to the underworld. The trio are able to bribe their way onto his boat with some drachmas stolen from Krusty. Thanks, Krusty. After a disturbing trip down to the underworld, the trio land on the shores of Erebus, only to discover the partially invisible Cerberus, who looks like a woolly mammoth-sized Rottweiler, blocking their way. Thanks to Annabeth's genius and a red ball, the three are able to bolt into the underworld via the easy gate and hide after they set off a bunch of alarms. Oops.
For a second, I thought that said, thanks to Annabeth's genius and a red ball. And I was like, I don't remember Red Bull being in this chapter.
A red ball.
Yes.
A little different.
Very different things.
Okay, so we meet Charon, who is not Chiron.
Yes. He does not like getting mixed up with that horse man.
Honestly, I think it's kind of genius for Rick to put this in there, because I know, especially as a kid, if you don't know all of the Greek myths, you wouldn't necessarily recognize the difference between Chiron and Charon.
Yeah, it's one letter different. Right. They look a lot alike.
But Chiron is the trainer of heroes and, you know, the
horseman?
Yes.
Centaur?
Centaur. I was like, what is the word? It's not satyr. The centaur versus Charon, who is the boatman who takes you down the river.
He's the boatman.
He is the boatman.
He is a boatman. Ferryman.
Ferryman.
Yeah.
But and he ferries souls down the river Styx to the underworld. Yeah. So very different jobs, but very similar names.
Yes.
But we do meet him, and we learn that he can be bought.
Yes, he can.
Enough drachmas stolen from a monster, which, very smart of them, by the way, to rob him blind after they chop his head off.
Is it robbing if he's already dead? I guess technically, probably.
He's a monster, so I'm sure he doesn't have a business license or whatever. He's probably just manipulating everyone, so
this is true.
He's just taking, you know, they took money fair and square as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, it's really smart of them to empty that out. Probably, I'm guessing Annabeth said, by the way, if we're going to the underworld, we're probably going to meet this guy and we're going to need extra drachmas. So, like, if there's any here, we're taking them.
Yeah.
It sounds like an Annabeth thing to worry
absolutely.
About.
Absolutely.
But yeah, so they buy their way onto Charon's boat and start.
I thought that was so cool, the way the elevator turned into the ferry. Like, that was so clever.
Like, it's going down and then all of a sudden starts moving forwards, and then it kind of just changes shape
and he changes like, oh, that was so, like, please, I can't wait to see this in the show. It's gonna look so amazing.
Like, him going from the human-esque visage that they could see, like, seeing his eyes hollow out and, like, I can there's okay, on Legacies right now there's a character that has died recently, and they are basically waiting to go find peace.
Okay.
And so there is Charon in Legacies on the end of the pier with his boat next to him, and they're waiting to get their gold coin. Like, they have to find enough peace to earn their coin to get on the boat to find. So there's this whole, like, I can kind of picture it because I've seen Legacy's version of Charon recently, and so I'm like, I wonder if you know, the Percy shows is gonna look similar. Like, so just one of those fun tidbits.
That's so cool.
But, like, his eyes in that show,
creepy.
They're so creepy.
Yeah.
And it kind of, like, lands a little bit for me, because I'm like, yeah.
Yeah. Oh, this is going to look so cool on screen. Oh, I can't wait. Yeah, my note on this part of the chapter is, of course the underworld looks like the Jersey Turnpike, because I am very anti-New Jersey in this household. Everybody knows that. Sorry if you're from New Jersey.
Karen is New York, New York. All the way.
Yeah. So that just, it made me laugh. Like, I love that Rick slanders L.A. and New Jersey. And I'm just like, you know what? Right there with you, guy.
I was going to say, I mean, I think New Yorkers have specific opinions about L.A. and Jersey.
Oh, yes. Yes, we do.
Us Midwesterners, we're just like...
caught in the middle.
Our land is flat.
Yeah. So flat.
Whatever. We'll come visit you wherever those places are.
Yeah. So one of the things in this chapter that I found absolutely fascinating was the preacher. So basically, there's a preacher in the underworld, and Percy's like, he clearly doesn't believe in Greek gods. Like, how is he here right now? And Grover says, well, who's to say he's seeing the underworld? Maybe he's seeing hell. It's like his version of it. And I think that when you mix, like, religions and even the different pantheons of gods through different mythologies, it's so interesting how he's incorporated this idea that all of them can coexist and that they're not necessarily wrong. It's just like different versions according to your beliefs, because a lot of, like, you know, the Greek gods only exist because of people's beliefs in them, and that's how we get, like, all the interesting scenarios with the Greek and Roman gods and how they kind of, like, switch back and forth between them. I found this part really, really interesting.
I think it makes it really approachable for people who, yeah, like, you know, I was raised Lutheran, so, like, I have a background in, like, you know, knowing a little bit about that side of things. And, like, I never question reading magical books and supernatural stuff. Like, it's fun, whatever. But I can see some parents maybe not fully understanding, like, my kid's reading a book about the Greek gods. Like, is this going to clash with our belief system? And, like, should I let them? Same with Harry Potter. We all know about the...
yeah.
The controversies there, which were silly.
I was
going
to ask, like, because I specifically remember Harry Potter and all of them being like, we can't let our kids read this and, you know, all that kind of dumb stuff. But, like, I wonder if there was any pushback with Percy Jackson.
Like, I think it was probably less so because Disney had done a version of Hercules and had told the story. And it made it feel like mythology. It didn't make it feel like another religion, which... it was a world religion at one point, and it, you know, still is or could be. But nowadays, people look at them more as myths, and they look at them as, you know, stories and allegories and things to, you know, use as, I mean, entertainment, but as a way to kind of ground a story in a really interesting world. And so I don't necessarily think that it alarmed a lot of people or anything.
Yeah.
But this does kind of give it an approachable idea, like... you know, if the kid has been learning in Sunday school or whatever about the Christian version of, you know, heaven and hell, and if here everyone goes to the underworld, like, that does kind of clash a little bit. But to get the idea that, like, okay, if you believe in heaven and hell in this book, here's what you would see if, mm-hmm. I mean, this preacher was not a good man and was going to his version of hell. So, like... he was definitely experiencing what he would, you know, he didn't expect to go to hell, I promise you that. but, like, you know, like, that's what he was seeing. So I think that's really interesting, and it makes it, again, it makes it really approachable. So
I'm thinking of Lamborghini for the Lord.
And I just, oh, my God, I died.
That was so
I
funny.
Died. It's so bad. And I'm like, it's...
but there really are, like, there are creatures out there that are like that.
There absolutely are. Yeah, but it I definitely thought it was, like, interesting and, again, made it very approachable for
and really
people.
Really clever.
Yeah, very cleverly done.
Yeah.
And it made me, like, just appreciate Rick all the more. Because, you know, there are a lot of different people reading these books, and they'll have a lot of different ways of kind of making it work
That's
for them.
What I was thinking of. In Magnus Chase, Samira believes in, like, her religion and her god and everything, and yet still understands that, like, there are different gods out there. Like, he's, from the beginning, has been really good about making it feel like they can coexist without... like, one necessarily being wrong or whatever. So,
yeah,
that's so cool.
Yeah, especially when your child is reading these books for entertainment. They're reading these books because, you know, they love to read and they love characters and all of that. Just finding a way to be inclusive of things in the real world that could affect someone's enjoyment of the story is really cool.
Yeah.
Like, he's found a way to kind of make it so that everybody's worldview fits in, and that's really neat.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, we should talk about Cerberus really quick.
We should, because I love him. I would die for him. Oh, my God. I almost cried at the end of the chapter when he just wanted Annabeth back. Like, I got really emotional
Karen
about it.
Karen cries when Annabeth cries.
Yeah.
Because Annabeth cried.
Yeah.
No, I just love that, you know, if you've seen Hercules, which we just talked about, you kind of have this idea of, like, what Cerberus is. He's big, he's scary, he's, you know, a three-headed monster, and you're like, ah, he's a big dog, but he's a big, scary dog. But not so much, really.
Yeah.
He's misunderstood.
He just wants love and attention. Actually, that happens in Hercules, too. Like, Hercules actually pays attention to him and cares about him, unlike Hades. And so then Cerberus is loyal to Hercules, not Hades. And it's kind of a similar idea here. Yeah.
It's very sweet. And honestly, this is the kind of thing that Rick does really well, where, like, you know, Cerberus could have just been another obstacle, another monster. Mm-hmm. But instead, they find another way. They find a way to distract him and kind of turn him into a puppy dog.
Yeah.
Who just wants a ball and some love.
Yeah. Don't we all?
I can't remember if they bring him another ball, but they should.
Yeah, I know.
Okay. I think that pretty much wraps up this chapter. When we leave them, they're hiding. They've snuck through the Jersey Turnpike turnstiles, and now they're...
And all the alarms are going off, right? Yeah.
So they're hiding behind a dead trunk, I believe, like of like a rotted tree or something, and they're waiting for the heat to cool off and, you know, for people to stop looking for them.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that pretty much wraps up that part of the discussion. We need to do favorite quotes and favorite moments, though.
Yes.
And mine is from Charon, right as they're about to enter, you know, they've already talked their way onto the elevator. So they're about to enter, and Charon says, right, now, no one get any ideas while I'm gone, he announced to the waiting room. And if anyone moves the dial off my easy listening station again, I'll make sure you're here for another 1,000 years. Understand? I just love it.
Yeah. It's funny. Mine's actually from Charon 2, and this is when they get down into the underworld, and they're on the river Styx, and Percy's noticing, like, all this stuff in the river, and Charon says, polluted. For thousands of years, you humans have been throwing in everything you've come across, hopes, dreams, wishes that never come true. And I thought this was, like, a very deep sentence, and I have to admit, one that I didn't necessarily understand. Like, I really like what he's saying, and I feel like I kind of get the concept. But is he saying, like, he's, like, humans have been tossing away their dreams, or they're, like, because this has to do with death, and, like...
I think on their way to the underworld, they're letting go of the things they didn't get to accomplish in their lives. Because if you think about it, the only reason a human or a spirit would be in the boat near the river Styx would be if they were going to the underworld. So I imagine that, you know, during that ride, you're kind of running through all, you know, your life. You're taking a moment to look back and, you know, as you go, maybe you're letting go of things that you never accomplished or things that you wish you could have done. Like, I can see how
I guess that would make sense, because he had talked about how Percy and them were so direct wanting to go to the underworld, and how so many of the spirits that come to him are like, no, like, it's too early. It's not my time. I don't want to go. So if they're being ferried across the river Styx, if they're thinking about all of the things that they didn't get to accomplish, it's kind of polluting their death rather than just accepting it. It's, you know, filling them up with all of these regrets. And so
as they cross, it kind of leaches out of them.
I thought it was like very kind of a very poetic line and a very deep line amidst, you know, everything else that's going on.
It absolutely is. And it's one of those things, again, that Rick does really well, is like mixed in with all the silliness of Cerberus and the ball and all of that. Like, we have these really incredible moments that honestly is what makes it readable for older generations, for older people, because you do have these really deep, interesting things to think about that you don't necessarily catch the first time, the first dozen times you read it. Like, you know, you may gloss over it because you're so excited to get to the underworld and see what's next. And if you take a moment and just kind of look at it, it's like, wow, that's really poetic and really deep. Okay, and now our favorite moments. Mine is Percy's skilled negotiation with Charon. I'm, again, just impressed by Percy because while I still do believe that it was Annabeth's idea to grab the drachmas, like, Percy takes charge of this. He doesn't even, you know, look to them really for help, to Grover or Annabeth for help. Like, he's just ready to go. He knows what his job is. They've made a plan before walking in there, but, like, he doesn't second guess himself and he just, you know, starts talking and talks Charon into letting them into the underworld, even though they're not dead.
Yeah. Yeah, and I almost think it's to his benefit to not be that familiar with this world, because, like, with Ares, the other two were like, oh, we have to be really careful, and he was just like, screw you, buddy. Like, he wasn't afraid. Maybe not the smartest thing when it comes to Ares, but kind of just having this confidence that comes from ignorance sometimes can be enough to trick somebody into doing what you want them to do.
I mean, sometimes ignorance is bliss.
Yeah, it really is. It should come as no surprise that my favorite moment is Cerberus, because he was so cute. I want a three-headed dog.
Might be hard to get for Christmas.
Mouths to feed.
Least, so cute, though.
At least it only has one back end. So, although, would it poop twice?
Three times as much? Yeah.
Maybe. Ugh. This is an interesting conversation that we are not going to continue.
The biology of a three-headed dog. Tune in next time. No, I'm kidding. We will not be going through that. All right. That pretty much wraps up our discussion of chapters 17 and 18. Next time we will be reading chapters 19 and 20. So read on, folks. Prophecy Radio is produced by Subjectify Media. You can follow our website on Twitter, Facebook, Tumblr, and Instagram at Subjectify Media, or visit us at SubjectifyMedia.com. We are home to three other podcasts, including Rewatchable, where we rewatch canceled and cult classic shows, Not About the Weather, which is a general interest show that sometimes features interviews with creators, and Not Another Teen Wolf podcast, which was recently revived thanks to the upcoming Teen Wolf movie. Contact Prophecy Radio directly on Twitter at Prophecy Podcast or on Instagram, Facebook, and Tumblr at Prophecy Radio Podcast. You can also email us at prophecyradiopodcast@gmail.com, and we would love to hear from you. You can find us on Spotify, Apple, or any of your favorite podcast platforms, and please consider leaving us a review or a 5-star rating, because they really do help other people find us. Feel free to leave us questions, comments, ideas for things you'd love to, you know, love us to see us cover, or episodes you'd love to listen to. We did get one piece of feedback this week.
Whoop, whoop.
Thank you to our friend Venus at Venus Phoenix with two X's on Twitter. Karen, do you want to read the tweet?
I would, because this made me very emotional. Venus says, so happy to meet other fellow adults that still love Percy Jackson and Rick Riordan's other books. I also love Vampire Diaries, too. Currently listening to your first episode of your podcast on Spotify. Thank you so much. That really means a lot. And yeah, I'll talk to anybody about Percy Jackson, but it's especially cool to meet other adults who really enjoy Percy Jackson and who kind of get that these books still work for an adult audience. So when I read this the first time, it did actually make me a little emotional. So thank you so much for tweeting us.
I just remember being really happy because I was like, yay, other adults. Like, I would be really excited if kids were finding and listening to our podcast. Like, that would be awesome. Mm-hmm. But I also love that, other adults that love these books are finding us, too, which is awesome. Okay. And with that, next week, get ready for our gift guide.
Yes.
So for all the Percy Jackson fans in your life, if you're having trouble figuring out what to get them, we will have some suggestions. So tune in then.
Yeah, and please, if you have any suggestions for us, if you have a favorite shop or, you know, a favorite item that you've gotten in the past, let us know and we'll try to include it best we can.
Sounds good. All right, this is Kristen.
And I'm Karen.
And we're Prophecy Radio, signing off. Over and out.